Greetings, time travelers, and welcome to another installment of Who's On. This is our 20th installment, and today we're going to be discussing Silence in the Library and the Forest of the Dead. The first time we see River Song. This is Dan's choice, and it is 1 month before we're going to see Doctor Who on screen again, Peter Capaldi. So we have been filling in with older episodes, giving you background stories of Doctor Who. And moving forward, we'll be doing more actual stuff that's airing at the moment. So that's going to be exciting. Now, Dan. Dan's on Skype, of course. If you've listened to Who's On podcast before, you'll know the situation. Rob is to my right, and Dan is on Skype in the village of Pennsylvania, USA.
Hello.
And I am Barry. I seem to always forget my name, but it doesn't matter.
It's all right.
You're as long as my wife remembers.
Yeah. You're a nameless ghoul.
Yeah. Man with no name. Tell us the reasoning behind your choice this month.
Well, having always said, every time we would revisit River Song, I always thought it would be nice to go back once her story was really told, to go back and rewatch her first story and sort of with the hindsight or the foresight, depending on how you're looking at it, be able to maybe get more appreciation out of like the way her character acts towards the Doctor. One thing I actually notice is I thought she was more smug in this, but she's not. She kind of has like a level of smugness that does not diminish or increase, I think, in her episodes. But I thought it was nice to return after. I believe that her story is pretty much finished. I mean, the last time we saw her, she was a ghost in the machine, essentially, and only the Doctor could actually see her. So it seems to me that, you know, her story, so not necessarily saying she's not going to come back at some point, but I think in terms of her arc.
Right.
So I thought it was nice to go back, because I haven't seen this since it aired in 2006? Or no, it was like 2008.
2008, yeah. May 31st and then June 7th for Forest of the Dead.
Oh, yep.
2008. So there was chatter about Peter Capaldi possibly seeing Alex Kingston. Hmm. And the recurring character, River Song. Have you heard anything about that, Dan?
No, I haven't heard.
Okay. So, yeah, I'm assuming that her story is complete as well.
I mean, they could still bring her back as sort of, you know, a companion. Or not a companion, but like a guest star. But, I don't really know if there's really more to explain about her. I think we pretty much know what we need to know.
The only problem I find with that, though, is there was that whole journal worth of stuff that, you know, we never... I mean, obviously enough, we don't necessarily see everything that goes on in the life of the characters, but...
Yeah, they mentioned the Byzantium.
There was, you know, there's a lot of stuff that...
Yeah, I mean...
But at the same time, I don't know.
I mean, like, her main arc, I would say, you know.
Right.
In terms of, like, the mystery of her character, we understand now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You know, that doesn't mean that they can't bring her back. I mean, I think it would be interesting, actually, as Barry was saying, to see her interacting with Capaldi's Doctor.
See, I can't get as deep into it until a little bit later on, but... I don't think that her story is done, but
okay.
I'll get into it a little bit more later on because there are some other stuff we got to cover before we get to that.
Well, I'd like to do sort of a quick overview, really. I don't want to go deep into plot one after the other. For the most part, these stories, you know, just perfectly run into each other, and as a whole, an hour and a half long, like a classic story. So mm-hmm. The story is told properly.
Oh yeah,
I didn't feel like we were cheated in any plot point.
No,
it's a for me.
I didn't felt rushed. Like
no,
felt there was time to give characterization to all the characters.
Exactly, and Moffat did a wonderful job. This is a Moffat story within the Russell T. Davies universe.
Which I didn't even really think about until you just made the point. I read that his name was on it, but I didn't really think about the connection until now. So, okay.
And Moffat gave a foreshadowing of what he thought River Song was going to become.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas her doctor, my doctor, and if you just play the clip real quick of River Song talking about who we now know and love, Matt Smith.
You know, it's funny, I keep wishing the doctor was here.
Doctor is here, isn't he? He's coming back, right?
You know when you see a photograph of someone you know, but it's from years before you knew them, and it's like they're not quite finished, they're not done yet. Well, yes, the doctor's here. He came when I called, just like he always does. But not my doctor. Now my doctor, I've seen whole armies turn and run away, and he'd just swagger off back to his TARDIS and open the doors with a snap of his fingers. The doctor in the TARDIS. Next stop everywhere.
Spoilers.
And there at the end you hear David Tennant say spoilers. He also actually, he's the first one that coined spoilers too. And River Song just used it.
Yeah.
Use his own words against him, essentially.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That is interesting, though, that line, just sitting there. She is describing, you know, Matt Smith's doctor.
She
you
really
know,
is.
Like it's
mm-hmm. And you can see his tails, you know, that he wears fling mm-hmm. around a little
yeah,
bit
when
he swaggers off.
And his little sachet he does with his shoulders and everything. Yeah, exactly.
His hands moving and very... What was it? The war doctor said, can you talk without your hands moving about?
So Silence in the Library is set in the 51st century. And that's the most popular century, really, other than the 20th,
mm-hmm.
That Doctor Who is set in. And we have a lot of backstory from the 51st century. Without getting into too much detail, Talons of the Wang Xiang, Magnus Greel is from the 51st century. Jack Harkness is from the mm-hmm. 51st century. That's when the time agents started. And if you've listened to the podcast before, we've gotten a little deeper into that in other podcasts. But, and if you want to know more about the 51st century, I advise the TARDIS Data Core.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's .com.
Yeah.
Which is a wonderful resource for everything Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give them a plug.
Yeah, I was actually on there last night doing a little research after watching the episode.
And what did you feel about the episode?
I had forgotten how good it was. You know, the story in whole. It's funny because when I first started watching it, I had completely forgot about the whole thing with the little girl. And I was like, is this even the right episode? And then I was like, oh yes it is. That's right. You know, but yeah, like I said, I just had completely forgotten how good the story was. I forgot that it was River's... I didn't forget that it was River's first episode. I just hadn't really thought about it. But it's funny because I said to my wife when I was watching, I was like, you know, it's kind of sad because this is the episode that introduces one of the most frustrating characters in all of Doctor Who and one of the coolest villains in all of Doctor Who.
Right.
I don't know. I just thought it was interesting because it's the story is just good. And I completely forgot how good it really is.
Well, Dan's discussed Moffat's monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was actually going to bring that up. It's one of, I think, the real knacks that Stephen Moffat has is his ability to create really memorable monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And really what he does, and I think in interviews what he does is he takes common everyday items and he makes them scary.
Yep.
And that's really... That's like working on a fear level as like a child. And I think that's what's most effective about it is when adults see it, we like revert to children in a certain sense.
Mm-hmm.
And we're being scared like children again.
Yeah. I think it's kind of like when the American version of The Ring came out, how like mm-hmm. all the imagery and it was all stuff that you could totally see just walking around your daily life. But it was portrayed in such a way that it kind of made you like, get disturbed by it. Not so much while watching the movie. For me, it happened more after seeing the movie.
Like, that's what I made an impression.
Like, yeah, like the movie, the way that they filmed, like, all this stuff. You know, like, even something as simple as the close-up of, like, the horse's eye. Now, like, anytime I'm somewhere where there's, like, a horse or a pony, I'm like, ah, you know. It's just a good job, like you said, that whole feeding on, like, childhood fears.
Yeah, it's an archetypal fear. First of all, fear of the dark.
Yeah.
Fear of forests.
Mm-hmm.
Dark, you know, forest, that, I mean, we want our little four walls. We want to put artificial lighting to mm-hmm. make the dark go away.
Yep.
Because bad things happen in the dark. Mm-hmm. You know, children are scared, and the stories are there so that, you know, children are first entertained and then scared the heck out of, so that they don't step out into the dark where mm-hmm. there could be a wolf or.
Yep. Yep.
And the, like, cite another example, like the girl in the fireplace. There was monsters under her bed.
Yep.
You know? Mm-hmm. The clockwork automatons.
Right.
I think even like the silence, you know, I mean, yeah. it's the typical, it really, when you look at it, basically, it's the typical gray that we see all the time. You know, it doesn't really look that scary.
Somewhat,
But at the same time, like, they're wearing this crumpled up suit, which is kind of in itself a little bit disturbing, because who would actually wear, like, you know, a black suit with
alien
a white shirt,
mobsters.
Black, yeah, well, aside from the alien,
like Secret Service or something like that, right. They're wearing those kind of suits.
Yeah, so I don't know.
And there's so many great little scenes, you know. The little girl. First of all, her backstory that they get into, as you have someone who. The archaeologist who makes or wants the doctor and Donna to sign this confidentiality form and things. He's obviously hiding some secret that he eventually has to reveal at the end, which is, and it works. It works wonderfully in the story. And Moffat draws on so many stories in this episode that you automatically think of different stories. The cell.
Mm-hmm.
You think of where, if you haven't seen The Cell, it's where there's a dreaming kind of world and you can be put into that world as a real interface.
Mm-hmm.
Tron, even.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tron, The Matrix.
The Matrix, you know. Alice in Wonderland through the Looking Glass.
Mm-hmm.
And
Dark City.
Yep, yep.
Mm-hmm. So it just makes you think of all these other great stories. And great authors do draw on other mythologies.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's all, it's, every story has been told in one way or another. It's just another way to retell it. And this is a brilliant way mm-hmm. to introduce these characters, these bad Vashta Narada,
yep.
and
yep.
River Song,
mm-hmm.
and Cal,
yep.
being the little girl.
Yeah. Well, it's really neat how, you know, as you were saying before, when you told me what we were going to be doing, all the correlations to it, to the time traveler's wife. And it's really neat how,
right.
even with this story, they're telling the story of River and the Doctor from River's perspective anyway, because she's the one that brings in the relationship to begin with. So
yeah, from what I was reading, he wanted them to know each other, but then he said, "Nah, that's too pat. I want something a little bit different." So the way he made it was so that only one of them knew each other,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a great, you know, tool that
mm-hmm.
he saw the error in what he was about to do, where it was going to be too normal.
I still think the way he chose to make the Doctor trust her is a little bit, I mean, that was his thing last year, though, you know, the name of the Doctor. So I guess he was just playing up into what he was going to be doing down the road with that. But yeah.
We've got a few like little awesome tidbits from the Doctor. I don't land on Sundays. Sundays are boring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tennant's sense of humor. You hear him use the word spoilers to Donna Noble first.
Mm-hmm.
And the psychic paper is used. And I guess
which is used in a weird way, too. Did it ever time travel before? I don't remember that the psychic paper ever time traveled.
Or somebody else using the Doctor's psychic paper to tell him a message? Yeah, I'm not sure of that either.
I thought it was usually that it impressed whoever was reading it. I didn't think it worked differently, but...
Or whoever had the touch of it. I don't know.
But then again, River spent much more time with the Doctor, so maybe she figured out how to make things work better. She figured out how to make the sonic screwdriver work better than it did for him, so...
With a red setting.
Yeah, with a red setting, exactly. But... whatever.
Proper Dave. I like Proper Dave as opposed to the other Dave.
Yeah, it was
that was cute.
What was the other? What did he call himself?
I think it was Other Dave and Proper Dave.
Is that what it was? Yeah. Other Dave and Proper Dave.
Yeah. It's funny too because
that's such an English thing.
Because my wife, if she has someone with the same name at work, she makes everyone call them Bob.
That works.
Like, no, that's not her name. Her name is now Bob, and so everyone at work calls that person Bob until they leave.
Okay.
Miss Evangelista, I want to talk about her because I think she's a really cool character. Overall, you have her introduced as this dumb brunette who can't put two words together.
Yeah, what was the line? A pretty face and no use for a brain or something like that.
Yeah, she had to be told something, you know, twice where to. And then she, the ghosting was really neat. That's a great plot device so that they can continue to talk. Because I always wonder that the consciousness of people, you know, data ghosts is one thing, but the consciousness of people if they pass away,
right?
Like what happened? Like all of a sudden you can die in a split second. You're alive. Your blood's flowing. You know, we have that spirit in us, you know, kind of thing. And then boom, we're dead. Mm-hmm. Where does that consciousness go? And I thought that the data ghost, how technology can be used to.
Right.
Is really a neat idea. And so she's the first one we really see that with. And then when she comes back, she's sort of like this warped Photoshop thing on there with her face. And to me, she was almost like she was preaching the gospel of the truth of what was really going on to Donna Noble.
She was trying.
In this, like, so Miss Evangelista was evangelizing.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, the evangelist. Okay.
Right. That's sort of where I thought Stephen Moffat was coming from.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought the whole thing with Donna was really interesting because she picked up that something was wrong right off the bat. But she, you know, it wasn't until, you know, Miss Evangelista kept making the point, look at the kids. There are only two kids. You're not paying attention. And you need to look and see what's wrong. And it also kind of reminded me of The Girl Who Waited, too, once I started thinking about it. The whole idea that she's in this computer and, you know, she's living this whole life. You know, she got married, had kids and all that. But,
yeah,
you know, it was fake.
Was that a Moffat story?
I'm pretty sure it was.
What was it?
The Girl Who Waited. When Rory dies again?
You know, I don't remember off the top of my head.
What was that? The Dream Lord too, right? He was...
No, I don't think he was in that one. That was the one where Amy was on, like, the planet by herself.
You're talking about the one with two Amys?
Oh, yes. Two Amys. All right, yeah.
You had, like, Xena Amy and you had, like, regular Amy.
Xena Amy.
It's the only way I could think about it.
That was actually written by Tom McCrae.
Oh, okay. It just kind of was reminiscent of that to me, the whole situation of living a life one way and then running into yourself again. And yeah,
wasn't Turn Left kind of went into that too? And that was another Donna. So the things on their back,
right.
And there was like a whole thing if she would have turned left, you know, like this whole other life would have been possible.
Yeah,
that's an instructional. That's for anybody, you know, that our choices will eventually, that's what I'm always looking for, something that's a little deeper than just watching the story, I guess. But maybe the second time I see something, I'm looking for that kind of thing. The first time I'm just sitting back and.
Yeah, I usually do that. I mean, yeah.
And there were some memorable quotes in this. Memorable quotes, Dan.
Who turned out the lights? Hey. Oh, it's hey. Who turned out the lights? Got the hay for that.
Yeah, like we didn't hear it enough times, right?
And was it Donna Noble has been saved? Donna Noble has left the building or
left
something
the
like
library.
That?
Elvis has left the building, but Donna Noble has left the library.
Yeah.
Has left the library,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I just think in general, whatever, 4,022 saved, no survivors.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, so I like that reveal when the doctor actually figured out what that meant.
Yeah, that was good. That was good.
And he actually communicates with the Vashtinirada. He says, we didn't come here. These are our forests.
Mm-hmm.
And so that you realize how they got there through what they describe spores in the
pulp. He said that, in the pulp, that they came from the pulp in the pages, which I remember originally watching it, and even watching it this time, I'd forgotten where that came from. But I was sitting there thinking, please tell me that means that they're going to talk about how this used to be a planet full of trees, and it was a forested planet, and they came and wiped it all out and made it a library, and but they didn't leave. But no, it was about the books.
Which is fine by me.
Hey, you know what?
Because you know what?
At the same time, you think of that whole childhood fears thing, and you think about reading books and how you get to live life, live lives and have experiences that you wouldn't in real life.
Exactly.
So in some ways, it's almost better that way anyway.
Exactly. And for people who don't know, what I really do in real life is make books.
Yeah.
So this had like a special kind of connotation for me, because he said, even with all the technology, and we have Kindles and whatever that Barnes & Noble one was, the Nook or whatever that failed, things like that, that even in the future, there will be books. There's nothing like having a bound book with pages and a leather binding and, and glue.
No, definitely. And the smell of opening it.
Exactly.
After, been sitting there.
There's something magical just about the book itself. Mm-hmm. And that, we write these wonderful stories down on a thing that has its own story, for the most part, when it comes to trees. And I mean, they have a ring, and they tell a story of each season. And what we do with it is make pulp and put glue on it and make paper and then bind it all together in our story. It's just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And how that will never die, because God forbid it dies, because then I will be out of a job.
but I think it's a medium that hopefully people recognize that you don't need to stay by an outlet to make sure you can continue to read your story.
Exactly.
You don't have to worry about, I don't have my connection to Google. I can't go and download my book from Play or even just...
You can't turn a page. See, that's the thing for me. You can't...
Have
it in your hand like a resting as a book. It's you read computer screens and I can't sit and read computer screens. And I mean, I can read like a story or two in the morning or whatever, but then it's like I'm done with the computer.
Yeah. My computer is just the medium to get my ebooks from the website onto my device, because I can't sit in front of the computer and read, but. I have like a tablet that's about the size of a book, so it's comfortable, I guess. Nothing like having an actual bound book in front of me, though.
Computers don't dream. No, but little girls do. I thought that was an interesting quote, because we've always hear about these stories where the computers become sentient.
Right.
And that they... have some kind of vitality and life and consciousness all their own. And so Moffat's just like...
But, where is the line between the computer and the person? Because her intelligence, her mind, her mental capacity has been uploaded into the computer.
It's a hard drive.
Therefore becoming the computer. So, the line's a little blurry. But I'll bring Philip K. Dick into it and say I do think that androids dream of electric sheep, but that's beside the point.
Well, there's even a line, and I don't think it was in the original 2001 A Space Odyssey, but sequel, 2010. Mm-hmm. But Hal actually asks his programmer when he's going to be shut off. It's like, will I dream?
Yeah, I think that's at the end of 2010. I think that was at the culmination of the story.
We have made so many thinking computers too that can predict certain things, and you always wonder. Well, at least the sci-fi part of me always wonders.
Hey, I got nothing to say on it. I'm just going to ride the wave.
Robots who are built. Did you hear that story in Japanese robots? Have you heard this, Dan? Where their robot got attached to a certain person, and then they became like psycho for that person?
No, I didn't hear about that. I've heard stories of like programmed artificial intelligence
that
will kind of like attach itself to not even like a robot, not like autonomous in the sense, but like, you know, a machine that it's so used to interacting with one person that I think it's it, I think in the cases I'm thinking of, it's more just that it got used to the way that the semantics were with one person, so it had a hard time adjusting itself to somebody else.
There's even a Twilight Zone episode like that, and these programmers go in to fix this computer, which is supposed to be making these calculations, but the computer is more concerned with the person's personal life.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of each one, they show two operators who are completely lost it because of this computer.
Mm-hmm.
And watch out for that femme fatale, because it was a female personality in this computer or whatever.
Yep.
And that's way back in the 60s when mm-hmm. computers were first around. That idea has always been in story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rod Serling, of course, the master of thinking 50 years ahead of time, at least.
At least, yeah. But I think it's one of those things, though. As soon as we started saying, you know, you could teach a computer how to add 1 + 1, you know, then automatically, you know, as well, then we can teach it how to think. You know, we can teach it how to feel. I mean, you know, the fact is, with AI has existed for a while now that is pretty much AI. It's just very slow and, you know, I don't know how intelligent it gets, but with some of the stuff they've been working on with, like, you know, quantum computing and everything like that, I can only imagine what that's going to do for AI and, you know, pushing that forward. Because that's, you know.
Well, you're better at that than I am. Dan is, too.
Yeah, I think of my computer as a sentient.
Yeah.
Well, damn it. My computer's General Zod.
That's right. Yeah.
I just certainly hope my computer's not sentient, because if it is, then that explains an awful lot of what's been going on lately.
Dan's computer arrived on a little disc.
The sound clips that plays on my computer boots
Broom. Neo before Zod.
Gene Wilder from Young Frankenstein saying it's alive. It's alive.
Nice.
not the original Frankenstein. I chose the Young Frankenstein Gene Wilder version.
Yep.
I don't know why. I just got attached to it.
I have
because
Stan
Gene
Laurel.
Wilder
on mine.
Has, yeah.
Stan Laurel is the one that I hear opening up my computer, and then when I shut it down, I hear Stan Laurel. So.
Yeah. I was being kind of sarcastic the last time I had a sound clip on it, and I used the Windows 95 bing, ba-ding, ding, 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 thinking it was kind of funny because, you know, I'm a Linux user, so to be using like the Windows 95 startup sound was kind of ironic to me.
Chris, when I shut my computer down, I have Monty Python, and I think it's Terry Jones and like his woman's voice saying bye bye. So.
What's Dr. Moon's function here in this story, Dan?
He is the guide mm-hmm. for Cal, specifically.
Charlotte Abigail Lux.
Yes.
He is the Dr. Moon.
Yeah.
Yes, he is Dr. Moon in her world. And, in her world, he's a psychiatrist, I guess. That's like the role in the fantasy world that he plays.
Mm-hmm.
But there's more depth to that than is on the initial surface.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think he's in charge of security and making sure that Cal doesn't mm-hmm. fry herself, basically.
Yeah, basically.
Integration for the people that were saved.
Yeah, he mm-hmm. helps people remember.
Or forget. Yeah.
Or forget, yes.
Yeah. I just thought that was kind of interesting, too, just the fact that he's not just Cal's keeper, that, you know, he's there to, you know, he's there for the security of the entire system, you know, that, like, anybody that gets integrated, he has to make sure that they're fitting into the system and they're not going to, you know, screw anything up.
Yeah, they don't want the whole world to, like Miss Evangelista, they don't want the whole world to fall apart, and she was trying to get Donna to realize what was going on.
Exactly.
Is he the tutorial, essentially talking in computer terms?
Probably.
You know, the little animated tutorial thing, you know, that you can get in some
doggy
computer programs.
Yeah. Yeah, because you certainly don't want anybody sitting there remembering Zion and
starting
a revolt. And
exactly. that's what we're going to get into, really, too. Other than Donna being taken and everyone freaking out because they thought Donna was dead, which is awesome. Not that Donna being dead was awesome, but that something so catastrophic like that would happen in Doctor Who. I mean, last time we really saw someone Bite the Big One was Adric with Peter Davison.
Yeah, straight up. Yeah.
See,
I thought it was interesting, though, when you look at, I mean, we find out a little bit more later on, but it was weird to me that the library computers didn't seem to be too sure about how to do what it was doing, or maybe I should say it wasn't sure when to do the things that it was doing. Because I thought it was interesting that initially the computer says it you know, saved everybody, copied everybody. I don't remember if I'm jumping ahead or not, but anyway, that's okay. I think it's all out now. That originally, when everybody was being saved, they were the physical people in the library being saved, downloaded into the computer, whatever, blah, blah, blah. All right, so then with Miss Evangelista, when she's talking to Donna, she says, oh, well, you know, I was in the Wi-Fi, which I thought was kind of weird anyway, because why would you bother to connect to the computer system if you knew something was going on? To me, that's kind of like duh, IT people. If there's something wrong with the computer system, you don't just go and hook your computer up to that computer. God forbid it's a virus and you're going to die too. But whatever.
And you anyway, are way overthinking.
And then the third thing, though, which is not as overthinking, is why did the library wait until Donna tried to transport to download her, and then why did it wait until she was in the TARDIS to do it? When she was in the TARDIS, wouldn't she have been safe already?
I don't think she was actually physically in the TARDIS yet. It was almost like the transmat beam was putting her together in the TARDIS, and it intercepted it.
But what's funny, though, and then I'll stop with this because I will drive us crazy just talking about this one thing, is that later, though, too, the doctor says, you know, everybody that tried to transport out, or no, the library tried to transport everybody. But because it had gone into lockdown before it tried to ship them out, they were basically faxes queued, waiting for the firewall to open so that it could send them out to the receiving end. But I guess the computer, since it had been sitting there idle for 100 years, it like had kind of let Donna go out. But then it was like, oh, wait, no, that's right. I'm not supposed to trust any outboard connections. Let me stop that. And
the more important question for me is, if they got downloaded into the system, what happened to their organic bodies? And why would they just...
It was digitized. That's the point.
But how do they reappear then? How can a digital...
3D printing.
How did
3D printing. There's the answer again.
How did Flynn
it's,
come back?
2 weeks in a row. Daleks need a home planet to secure something. They don't have any hands. 3D printing.
Well, how did Flynn come back from the computer in Tron?
Oh, I don't remember. It's the same thing.
It's been a long time.
Yeah. No, but it's just the idea that, again, that everything was turned into digital information.
Right.
You know, so...
But what about our organic compounds?
Well, you could technically take organic compounds and turn them into ones and zeros. Or if it's a quantum computer...
But then to remake them?
The things that are halfway there.
But then to remake them 3D printing?
Sure.
I don't know.
Well, but at the same time,
Dan has the answer.
A 51st century 3D printer, which would be far more advanced than our current.
Well, exactly. I mean, you think about it. What would a transmat be anyway? Like, what would a teleporting device be anyway? It's breaking down the matter and then it's reassembling
itself. That's
true.
That's cool to think about, actually.
That's a good point.
So,
I'm going to
just took that signal and saved it to the hard drive.
My brain just exploded because I just totally thought about the whole idea of quantum computers and the fact that when we talk about wormholes, they talk about that being quantum physics. Oh.
But what if in the 51st century, or, you know, way before that, we were able to transmat based on the 3D printing principles?
Exactly. No, exactly. When you really think about it, quantum, when they talk about quantum, they're talking about, you know, with computers, right? You have bits. You have ones and zeros. And quantum computing is when they, I don't even remember what they call them. There's some kind of crazy name that they have for it. Quasal bit or... quintessence at blah blah blah, I don't know, anyway, but basically it's stored in a state where it could be one or zero.
Okay,
so each bit is not saving a yes or no, it's saving a maybe. So, you know, or not just that it's a maybe, but it's actually storing both at the same time, which is kind of what makes it disappear. You know, you kind of think about the whole idea, like, is it black or is it white? Well, it's neither, because it's both.
You are really appealing to my geek side right now, Rob.
Yeah.
And I'm just loving the idea of the possibility of it being a reality. You know, even though I would not really want to jettison all my bits.
Oh, believe me, I'm certainly not ready to be like, hey, I'll get in line for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like with Dr. McCoy on this, you know, having his atoms scrambled, not really.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Either that or I'm picturing, like, Spaceballs. Next thing you know, my butt's going to be in the front, and, like, now.
All right, that's an odd image I just put into my head. Oh, we got the Dr. Moon and Lawrence Fishburne Matrix comparison. We have a couple audio clips for you guys. And just we'll play, I guess, Dr. Moon first, since it's part of the episode. And then to play it off and contrast it, compare and contrast, children. Mm. Contrast it with the Matrix and how, let me tell you why you're here. Thing with the blue pill, red pill.
Yeah. Huh. Red mode. Ah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Red sonic screwdriver.
Oh, okay, never mind. I'm going to stop there. I'll get out of it.
It's a red setting.
Now, listen. This is important. There's the real world, and there's the world of nightmares. That's right, isn't it? You understand that?
Yes, I know, Dr. Moon.
What I want you to remember is this, and I know it's hard. The real world is a lie, and your nightmares are real. The library is real. There are people trapped in there, people who need to be saved. The shadows are moving again. Those people are depending on you. Only you can save them. Only you.
You're the one, Neo.
Stop trying to hit me in.
Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad.
And they even... They're even bald black guys.
With glasses.
With
little glasses.
Yep.
Little round ones.
I think the comparison was an obvious one for Stephen Moffat. He wanted people to think that, which is, I guess, a positive for whoever wrote The Matrix, and I can't think offhand.
Wachowski brothers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you look like you're done, just about.
Yeah. Well, Dan... I just loved the two episodes, and the fact that we don't have to go point by point, mm-hmm. you know, through each plot line. I mean, people have seen it. If they want to see it, they can, you mm-hmm. know, hook it up.
Yep.
I think it's just really important. Some of the overall kind of thing, where he got this or where he got that. And
yep.
especially when it comes to the Doctor Who universe, there's some, this falls in what, like episode 8 and 9 of season 4, I believe.
Yeah, it was. I think it was something like that.
It was 9 and 10.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, the production code was 4.9.
I mean, we have everything from River saying not one line is going to mm-hmm. get changed, and that's something that Tennant, you know, said over. Hartnell would say it, not one line,
mm-hmm.
and which is like a recurring theme in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
To Donna's stuttering lover, you know, mm-hmm. he's beautiful and he can't talk. He's the perfect thing for Donna, you know, Catherine Tate yep. from Chiswick.
Yep. Yep.
Oh, I'm going to talk about Donna.
Go for it.
Let's finish. Did you have another point, or is that?
My point lies with you, Dan.
Okay. Well, one of the things is going back and watching this is seeing how great Donna's character was for David Tennant's Doctor. She was the ideal companion, I feel, for David Tennant's Doctor. I mean, I honestly didn't really care for Rose so much during David Tennant's first season. I think some of it was deliberate. I think Russell D. Davies wanted to make her character get too comfortable and be like, you know, like, eh, you know, I've done it all before, so I'm gonna be trying to be like the Doctor and be all glib. And then, you know, set up to the whole separation thing. And then my issue really with Martha was just, I don't think her character was really allowed a chance. The whole unrequited love thing. I don't know. I mean, call me old school, which I am anyway, so feel free.
Okay,
old school. But as an old school Doctor Who fan, I like companion and doctor relationships to be platonic. And that's one of the things I liked about Donna Noble, and I felt that she complimented David Tennant very well. And I'm actually hoping with Peter Capaldi entering the scene that a similar dynamic may fall into place with him and
Clara.
Yes. So there's that. But yeah, I remember actually when they introduced Donna in the
Runaway Bride.
I was really worried. Well, I didn't really care for her character. And then when they announced that she was coming back as a full-time companion, I was like, they're going to have to rework her character to make her more likable in order to make her work as a companion. And they did. And I thought that they did an excellent job. And seeing the interaction between Donna and David Tennant's doctor in this really, like, pleased me.
Yeah. I got a kick out of the whole, pretty boy, you're with me. Oh, she's talking about me. Yes, she is. That came out way too fast. Because she was totally, you know, like you said, she was definitely keeping it more platonic. She was certainly not the swooning over him kind of thing, but...
And she played the role of the companion, putting the doctor in his place.
Yeah, yes, the long, definitely. Thin streak of nothing, mm-hmm. she called him once.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she wanted nothing more than to be with him on his adventures.
Mm-hmm.
It was the perfect companion for David Tennant,
mm-hmm.
because he was so over the top impressed with himself,
yeah.
So that he needed someone to, you know, take him down a couple notches. Usually,
yeah, he was already having a little bit of the God complex, as we've talked about in the past. You know, he was already to the point where he needed somebody to calm him down a little bit.
And they made fun of that in the 50th anniversary, where he was. Yep. Telling the rabbit that he was the oncoming storm and all that.
Yep, yep. Then you're just true. A normal rabbit. Yeah, that was good. That was good.
No, but you're so right about Martha, about Donna. We do need some. The companions like that, it's like Barbara. Barbara is the blueprint of a wonderful female character who, it first of all, isn't defined by the male character in her life.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Donna did want to be with the doctor during that, it wasn't she had an identity apart, you know, from that, and that's what Sarah Jane became in a lot of ways as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that all the positive female characters, you know, I would think I guess Rose is a little bit in a different category, because the doctor never really had a love interest before in Doctor Who until Rose, unless you want to count, you know, the terrible 1995 thing.
That doesn't count.
Or 96.
Right. Paul McGann counts, but the story doesn't count.
Yeah. I mean, like falling in love with the doctor
then,
that killed him.
But then she
him,
didn't travel with him. So there is that.
Hmm.
Indeed. So, you know, when he offered the chance, she's like, nah, I don't think so.
She wasn't as spitten as maybe she wanted to be. You know?
Well, yeah, it was just one of those, you know, like, I would say forbidden fruit, but, you know, he's like an alien and he kissed her, you know, and so that's sort of...
He was a mystery man, so, you know, it was intriguing.
But that's the thing about the Doctor, and that's the, you know, quintessential about him as his character, is he's not, you know, to quote a phrase, he's not the marrying type.
Yeah.
Although he is technically married, but...
Yeah, well...
We won't get into that.
Yeah.
So we also find at the very end, he saves Rivers, mm-hmm. ghosting her digitized self,
mm-hmm.
to the hard drive, to the mainframe. And mm-hmm. so she forever, in Moffat's world, I guess, can come back in some way, like she did at Translore, like she did with Lady Vastra in the seance mm-hmm. thing, the cup of tea from the oldest memories, yeah. and sweet, a nice memory and stuff like that. So I guess theoretically she could come back at any point. What?
I was just going to make the point that this is actually another story that nobody died.
Yep.
But then when I was thinking about it, all of a sudden it dawned on me that there was like this really, 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 really big bump in the plot in the story that I just didn't even think about until right this second. And that's that everybody else that landed there with River were saved because of their neural link on the Wi-Fi. Yet for some reason, River is the only one that had to have the screwdriver to be saved. Because they make a big deal out of, oh, I saved her because I gave her the screwdriver, yet the computer was intelligent enough to save everybody else at the same time. Which is another point I'll make in a couple seconds, too. But
Dan, well,
it's possible that, I don't know the exact term of what she was doing, joining the two.
Oh, true. Tapes, yeah,
so whatever, maybe
it
was going to interfere with the computer's ability to save her.
Yeah, good point, good point. Yeah, she, like, overloaded it. That's actually a good point. She overloaded it. That's the whole point, was she was hooked up to it, so she fried.
That's why Dan is awesome, because I would have just agreed with you and not even thought of that whole...
Yep. So, the point that I've been holding off on, because it's just so big, and you have to take the whole episode in context, especially considering the first thing that I'm going to mention... happens at the very end. The first thing that I'm going to mention happens at the very end.
I thought you said the first painting.
Yes, the first painting I'm going to mention. Why did they wait to zoom in on Cal's face on the grass until she said one little sentence?
Yeah, I did notice that too.
Aren't I clever?
Yeah. And there some kind of thing about run.
I brought everybody here. Aren't I clever? Yeah. Aren't I a clever girl? And then, yes, there's another point when before River dies, she says, watch us run.
Right.
Why did she say it? There is no context for watch us run in what she was saying.
So you think that Moffat has some kind of foreshadowing going with Cal and
there's
Clara?
There's a red setting on the sonic screwdriver. When Cal's getting ready to destroy the planet, everything turns red for Donna. Remember, the sky turns red. Everything is red.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what else there was that was going on.
Oh, that's our whole red thing with
Clara and Cal.
Yeah, interesting.
And how about the fact that if you go back and watch the little prequel to The Bells of St. John, when the doctor runs into Clara as a little girl, she's wearing a pair of barrettes with her hair pulled back almost the same way as Cal is when they're standing on that grassy field again.
I thought you were going to mention that in the episode she's introduced, in the Dalek episode, she's wearing a red dress.
Well, she has some article of her clothing is red every time you see Clara.
Yeah, there's a constant red theme with Clara, but and I don't even know if it's sort of like we're supposed to look at some kind of metaphor with the imagery, like a red badge of courage kind of thing, or if it's...
See, the thing is...
It's intentional, or if it's just something to do with the prop people and the wardrobe people.
Every episode with Clara,
Yeah, I think there's an umbrella that's red in one episode.
Maybe she just looks good in red.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, maybe. It offsets her lips, right? I don't know.
But the other point, too, is if you think about Clara has shown up in three different times now. In three different times.
Three.
So, now also we've seen River across multiple different times. Time zones, if you want to call it that, whatever.
Wait, now you're connecting River. Now you're going too far. I call foul.
Okay.
well, River had the vortex manipulator.
Yep, she had that. But
you're
also
talking about literal time travel.
Well,
what are you talking about?
Well, what if? Okay, well, the library. Remember the interfaces. The interfaces that you talked to at the library, right? They looked into you and projected what you thought, like what you needed to see out of it.
Uh-huh.
Remember? So, now also, what about Clara when she was fighting with the TARDIS and the TARDIS projected her as the interface as well again?
Okay, I can understand Cal and Clara. I see that whole possibility in a future storytelling. But I don't see River as being...
What
part
if she's using Cal and the abilities that Cal has to kind of make sure that things happen the way they need to happen? Or
yeah,
it goes back to one of my original theories that none of what's taking place in these episodes is even happening.
Oh, that's...
No, but think...
That's crazy talk, Rob.
I'll bring in Stay, right? I'll bring Stay back into
okay.
it. Okay. So we're watching the story from the perspective of the Doctor.
Stay,
and how
Ewan McGregor's Stay?
Yeah.
And Ryan Gosling?
Exactly.
Okay.
We watch the movie from the perspective of Ewan McGregor.
It's a good movie.
basically, I'm going to spoil this for anybody who would ever not seen the movie yet.
Oh, so I guess I should
earmuffs.
Yeah, earmuffs, Dan.
But so, I can't even say this now without ruining it for Dan.
That's okay.
It's going to have to happen. It's going to have to happen. I'm sorry. You watch Stay, and you're watching it from the perspective of Ewan McGregor's life. Right, you're watching him go through his life, do his thing, and this weird guy just keeps popping up in the middle of nowhere for some reason.
I see where you're going with this. Okay.
So, if all of this, all of what we've been seeing, is River's life lived out in the library computer, but we're only seeing that from the perspective of the doctor.
Yeah, but they would have to be in the computer as well, if she was interacting with them, correct?
Not necessarily. Because Donna's kids weren't really in the computer.
But Donna's kids were, like, computer-generated.
Yeah, they weren't even real.
They were,
you know,
like,
what, Rob?
Which is weird, though, because they kind of hint that maybe they weren't, though, because at the very end,
child
though...
Child Skin 1 and Child Skin 2, you know?
Child Skin.
Well, what he said, though...
I'm thinking, like, Warcraft terms, you know, where you're looking up, you know, like, animal, like, pets, Warcraft pets, and they label, like, its skin type.
All right, now that we've isolated our audience, target audience, to like one person, we might as well just totally geek out here, I guess. Oh, there goes my microphone. Yep. Now for them to interact within Cal, that would make Cal like have... So you're saying that the stories that have happened within Cal?
Yeah.
Okay, so they haven't gone to Translore. They haven't gone to these other Christmas or any other planet. It's just all been within the Cal interface. So
maybe Matt not. Smith or maybe it's gone
like
back and forth.
And the whole crack.
Well, but at the same time, it could also be... Because remember, the reason why... They explained the reason why the kids all look the same was because it was easier to save space by compressing
that.
It down to the one image. If kids are all pretty much the same, we'll just make them all look like these two kids to save space. It said that, you know, the data banks were full in the computer. You know, it said that the memory was full up. That's why the doctor was saying he hopes there's enough room, and that's why he went to hook himself up to the computer. So, but if all of those other people were flushed out of it, then, you know... I don't know, maybe the doctor, like,
this
is
Rob, author of the book Pigeons and Me from A to Z, available in paperback and hardcover.
Listen.
And you should,
listen.
Because you're thinking about all this intricate, like plot work, like Stay. Okay, his point about Stay, Dan, and everyone who, well, the one person who's listening still, is that at the end of it, you find out that Ewan McGregor isn't really involved in his life at all. It's Ryan Gosling's perception of Ewan McGregor. Ryan Gosling is having a dream-like state that he has to wake himself up out of. So this weird person who keeps popping up in his life is the person who's having the dream.
Yeah.
So he can control certain things in the dream.
The main character is actually Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, but...
Because he's dying on the side of the road. But he's... But Ewan
like
McGregor...
Jacob Slatter, then.
Yes, very similar.
So...
But not as creepy.
Yeah, Jacob Slatter went more psychological.
Yeah, and more LSD military kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas Stay was just a poor kid whose tire popped with his family in the car.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess in a bit like Life on Mars, if you've seen that show at all.
No, I'm not knowing.
It's like a guy that's hit by a car and he finds himself in 1973.
Okay.
Mm. And... He thinks that he's in like a coma, and he keeps seeing like people talking to him, like, you know, like you need to, you know, focus, you know, if you can hear me. So he thinks he's in a coma, and he's like dreaming this whole thing. But I don't want to see now. I'm getting to the end. So if I, you know, someone out there who might be watching Life on Mars, you know, tell them, you know, how it ends, because that's part of the mystery of it all. But.
Hmm.
But it runs along similar lines, Stay, like.
Yeah, that sounds like it.
Like, you know, like, he was in, it was sort of like an afterlife kind of thing.
You know what, though?
Or it's like purgatory or something along those lines.
After all is said and done here, too, that really is a wonderful thing that Moffat has been able to draw on so many different things that we're actually talking about here that he probably didn't even think about when he was actually writing it, but yet deducting and picking it apart, you can see little things from so many different things, which is really a testament to the writing in these two stories. So if anyone hasn't seen it, we didn't go over plot really about these two episodes. I highly recommend Silence in the Library, Forest of the Dead, Dan's recommendation also for this month. Mm-hmm. As a little precursor to new stuff coming out, and we're excited for Peter Capaldi.
Yep.
Other than that, River Song has like, there's another story that you only hit on a little bit, and that's the whole Time Traveler's Wife story of, and the similarities that River Song has to the Time Traveler's life stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could look it up on Wikipedia and see the immediate similarities.
Yep.
To that, if anyone wants to do any further research on this, and also, of course, DataCore. TARDIS.datacore.com for any kind of backstory on the 51st century. Other than that, it's been fun.
Yeah.
And we'll see you guys soon.
Yeah, we will.
Bye.